The strange but true story featured on this podcast contains details some people may find distressing. Listener discretion is advised. I'm Chiaz Samuel, and things are about to get weird. Hello, welcome back. I'm so thrilled that you've tuned in today for another episode of Things Are About to Get Weird. Thank you for joining me. Now, back in our episode about the amazing Nellie Bly, I mentioned that I have a long-standing fascination with Victorian medical practices. To be honest, I'm fairly sure most of it came from reading both The Horrible Histories, Vile Victorians, and The Horrible Science, Blood, Bones and Body Bits books over and over again as a kid. I think the two must have merged in my brain somewhere along the way. And then this was added on to as I grew up and learned about people like Nellie and the mental health side of things. There's truly so much about this topic that it was one of the first things I put on my list of podcast ideas when I first started the show. There are 1,000 weird avenues to explore with this one. I've selected just a few to tell you about today. This is by no means an exhaustive history lesson. It's truly the tip of the iceberg, but that means I could always revisit this subject in the future in either a part two episode or a few weird fixed tales. And on that note, whilst the term Victorian of course refers to the reign of the British monarch Queen Victoria, I will also be making references to other countries in Europe and the US as well in this episode. I'm just using Victorian as a catch-all for the general time period. Also, I think this may go without saying, but I'm going to give the warning anyway, that there will be some gory details in this episode, and there will also be discussions around mental health conditions and treatments too. It's one of those occasions where I can't really avoid some of the details due to the subject matter at hand, but as always, I will be as delicate as I can wherever possible. There will also be some mentions of drug use within this episode too. Also, to be clear, I am not a doctor, I am not a medical professional. That disclaimer given, let's get started. I knew exactly where I was going to begin when it came to this topic, because like many of you I'm sure, when I think back to what I learned about Victorian medicine in school, the first person that comes to mind is the renowned Scottish surgeon Robert Liston, who began his medical training in 1810 and practiced until his death in 1847. But whilst he's often the subject of curriculum textbooks and multiple choice exam answers, he's also the central character in one of the most infamous strange but true stories in Victorian medical history. Now, in school, you might have been taught about the ways in which Liston revolutionised the concept of surgery. He was a key pioneer when it came to trying to reduce the amount of pain a patient felt during a procedure, in the years prior to anaesthetic being widely used in the UK. His method revolved around speed, as he believed that performing an operation as quickly as possible was the best way to manage a patient's pain levels. But what I don't remember being told about is the time he performed a single surgery that had a 300% mortality rate. Yes, you heard that correctly, and whilst it seems impossible and some are very sceptical about the tale, many experts on Liston's work firmly believe it really did happen. The author Richard Gordon has written about the fact that Liston could perform a leg amputation in just 2.5 minutes, alleging that on one occasion he managed to complete the operation in just 28 seconds. He really leaned into the spectacle of the whole event, encouraging onlookers who often crowded around him as he worked to time how long it took him to complete each procedure. More on all of that in a moment. But as impressive as these super quick turnaround times first appear, it looks as though Liston's need for speed would soon result in a truly catastrophic incident taking place in his operating theatre. Once, as he was about to start an amputation, he brought his blade down so quickly towards the patient that one of his surgical assistants didn't have time to move their hand out of the way. Liston ended up cutting off 3 of the assistant's fingers, which is horrifying enough, but it gets so much worse. As he swept his knife back around, he somehow managed to catch the coat of one of those spectating, and the man was so alarmed at being caught in the blade's path that he collapsed and subsequently died, possibly of a heart attack. Liston was determined to carry on though, and he finished the surgery he'd started. But there was to be no positive ending for either the patient or the surgical assistant. Both ended up with their wounds becoming infected, and the two perished shortly afterwards. Although this disaster is the one most frequently associated with Liston, he had plenty of other mishaps along the way too. For example, it's reported that he once accidentally sliced off a patient's testicle along with the leg he was meant to amputate. Yikes. Despite all of this, Robert Liston wasn't hesitant to merge his own showman-like techniques with the new advances in anaesthetic, once they became a viable option in the UK. In fact, he was actually the first surgeon to publicly perform an operation using the anaesthetic ether in December of 1846, and at last there was a more widely available solution when it came to patient pain and consciousness during surgery. Things didn't go totally smoothly, of course. There were plenty of tragic occasions where a patient would receive too high a dose of an anaesthetic, which would result in their death. And some argued that the concept didn't feel right from a religious standpoint, and that pain had been sent from God and therefore should be endured. But by and large, this did improve things for the Victorians when it came to pain. What it didn't solve, however, was the huge and deadlier problem of infection. And here's where we loop back to not only the issue of crowded operating environments, but a whole host of other hygiene concerns too. Now, one of the other key names you might remember from history class is Joseph Lister. Nice and similar and confusing there, but Lister is the surgeon who, during the 1860s, discovered and developed ways to help wounds heal with the use of antiseptics, after being inspired by the work of people like Louis Pasteur. This awareness of germ theory was obviously a complete game changer, and massively helped to increase the survival rate of patients who'd had surgery. But things weren't always so rosy. According to the author, Lindsay Fitzharris, Victorian operating theatres were commonly referred to as gateways of death, and the act of surgery was considered to be something of a spectator sport. In an interview with the BBC, she described how many of these operations were ticketed events, where not only medical students but members of the public would traipse into theatre covered in the quote, dirt and grime of everyday life, to watch surgeons in filthy aprons perform procedures that so often resulted in the patient's death that she likened them to slow-moving executions. Equipment was reused without being sterilised, and patients often had to pay for their treatment ahead of time because there was a good chance they wouldn't be around after the fact to settle their bill. So grim. The Victorian approach to hygiene during surgery was so non-existent that the presence of blood on a surgeon's apron was actually viewed as a badge of honour, according to Fitzharris. A quote by her, featured in the Washington Post, actually chilled me to the bone as someone who is quite obsessive about hand cleanliness. She said, "The thinking was, why wash your hands if they're just going to get dirty again? In the context of surgery, that is even more horrifying." Another strange but true fact is that many wealthy people opted to have surgery at home instead of in hospital, which today would seem like a very, very bad idea. But in the Victorian age, this usually meant that they had a higher chance of survival. Even though they didn't realise it yet, having fewer people crowded around whilst the operation was taking place meant that the chances of infection were naturally lowered. Now, when Joseph Lister introduced the use of antiseptics in surgery, most famously carbolic acid, which he fashioned into an antiseptic spray, which he used to clean both wounds and equipment, he was met with quite a bit of pushback from the wider medical world, because what he was fighting against, germs, bacteria, etc., were invisible. Many simply couldn't get their heads around the concept. They ridiculed him and thought they knew so much better, But of course, it turns out that he was onto something extraordinary. His work helped to kickstart a whole host of changes, which is why, thankfully, many of these harmful surgical practices were well and truly left behind in the Victorian era. His legacy lives on, though. Although it's a myth that he was the inventor of one of the most widely used personal hygiene products we have today, Listerine mouthwash, it was named after him as a tribute to all the surgeon achieved. One very important additional fact here relates to one of the most famous Victorians of all, Florence Nightingale. She has long been regarded as the nurse who completely revolutionised the practice, improving conditions vastly both at home in England and abroad during conflicts like the Crimean War. But some academics believe that she actually inadvertently predicted germ theory, despite being as sceptical about it as other leading medical professionals at the time. She believed that cleanliness and a sanitary environment helped to prevent disease, and she was of course correct, even though she didn't realise exactly why from a scientific standpoint. She is such a fascinating figure, I could talk about her for hours, but for the purposes of this episode today, I'm going to move things on. Because surgery was only one part of the equation when it comes to the topic of medical practices during the 18 and early 1900s. When we look at the more everyday side of medicine during this time period, it soon becomes clear that some of the most common afflictions were sometimes treated in the most bizarre of ways. There's really no other way to kick off this section other than talking about leeches. Even though leeches had been used in medical treatments for hundreds of years prior to the 19th century, in the early 1800s there was a huge boom in their popularity. According to the Old Operating Theatre Museum in London, in 1822, St Thomas's Hospital, located in the capital, racked up a grand total of 50,000 leeches which were used in medical bloodletting treatments. 50,000 in a single year. For context, that was 31 times more than the number of leeches used at the same hospital in 1818. And this wasn't just confined to this one facility. It was part of a wider so-called leech craze that spread all across Europe during this time. It seems that many of the physicians who were pushing the benefits of leeches were from France, including François-Joseph Victor Broussais, who believed that leeches could help to reduce inflammation of certain organs, which he thought led to fevers. He'd pop leeches onto the skin closest to whichever organ he thought was inflamed, and hoped that this would help to break the patient's fever. By 1833, France was exporting around 42 million leeches a year, which is wild. And there were also big leech farms in places like Yorkshire too, so England definitely got in on this trend. The general medical thinking at the time, and this is a very simplified version of the explanation, but it was believed that imbalances of four key bodily fluids, blood, black bile, phlegm and yellow bile, could lead to different illnesses. So by using leeches to remove blood from a person, you were effectively correcting excessive levels of blood in their body. Once again, as germ theory began to become more widely understood in the medical field, physicians' understanding of how the body worked evolved considerably. And after the mid-1800s, leeches began to decline in popularity. Although the creatures are still occasionally used to this day for certain limited medical reasons, the leech craze was a very Victorian trend, and I wonder whether it was somewhat of a self-fulfilling prophecy. There were so many leeches available to doctors in the early 1800s that perhaps they were more experimental and tried to use them for everything, convincing themselves that they were a magical cure-all. I have to be honest though, you would never catch me letting a leech anywhere near me. And I think, had I been a Victorian, I don't think my attitude would have been much different. It's not for me. I'll be coming back to this physical treatment angle later on when we talk about the mental health side of things. But for now, let's take a look at some of the strangest examples of Victorian medicine. First up, I'm sure that at one point or another, we've all heard the term snake oil salesman, used to describe scammers and people who sell products fraudulently, claiming that items are capable of achieving certain results when they don't do much of anything. And as it turns out, this term should be taken very literally when it comes to the topic of certain Victorian pharmaceuticals. During the 19th century, over in the United States, bottles of snake oil began to work their way into the medicine market. It's thought that the original product was literally derived from the oils produced by Chinese water snakes and had been used in China for a long time before its arrival in the US. In the 1800s, as the US continued to develop their railroad system, many labourers moved from China to the States to find work, and some brought with them numerous medicines and treatments that most Americans had never encountered before. Snake oil was originally used to help reduce inflammation in sore muscles, something that many of the railroad workers were afflicted with, and was even used as a remedy for the symptoms of arthritis too. Obviously, I can't speak to its effectiveness, I'm not a doctor or any kind of medical professional, but the original snake oil itself wasn't the problem here. The real issue arose when entrepreneurs from the US decided that they could replicate this product themselves, but ended up going about it in either very misguided or knowingly dodgy ways. One such chancer was a former cowboy named Clark Stanley, who came to be known as the Rattlesnake King. He would quite literally make a big show of the snake oil he was shilling. On one occasion in 1893 in Chicago, he got up on a stage, produced a rattlesnake, cut it open, and claimed that what he extracted from the snake was the same magical oil that had been brought over from China. But it wasn't. The government later tested bottles of Clark Stanley's snake oil liniment, as it was called, and found that it contained no snake oil whatsoever, just a mixture of mineral oil with possibly a little beef fat and other arbitrary ingredients. And this story was repeated around the US with other con artist salesmen, selling their cure-all potion that was far from being a medicine of any description. Then, there's a good chance you may already know about the infamous former use of one illicit drug in not only mainstream medicine, but also in the world's most popular carbonated beverage, Coca-Cola. And that was, of course, cocaine. The boom in medical cocaine happened around the mid-1880s. In a journal entitled Masters of Healing, Cocaine and the Ideal of the Victorian Medical Man by Douglas Small, it's noted that, quote, in the first 6 months of 1885, there were 67 pieces on cocaine in the pages of the British Medical Journal. It continued, to the list of uses enumerated in the British Medical Journal, it added, among others, cocaine's efficacy as a mild antiseptic, its value to women whose nipples were sore or chapped from nursing, as a tonic for digestive troubles and against wasting syndrome, to relieve the pain of caustic injections for syphilis, as a therapy for morphine and opium addiction, and, significantly for the drug's later career, as a stimulant and as an aphrodisiac. The story was very similar in the US too. In fact, by 1902, there were an estimated 200,000 cocaine addicts in the States. It was so freely available and used for so many ailments and in so many everyday products that this statistic felt somewhat inevitable, and it wouldn't take too long before governments caught on to just how addictive the substance was, and to the fact that it ended up causing many of the medical issues it claimed to help eradicate, things like sleep issues and depression. Later in 1914, the production, importation, and distribution of cocaine in the United States was outlawed under the Harrison Narcotic Act, bringing the Victorian-era above-board fixation with it to an end, and the UK followed suit in 1920. But this next example is even wilder. Towards the end of the 19th century, doctors began to realise that morphine, which was very widely used, was also very addictive, and they wanted to find a replacement for the drug. In the 1870s, an English researcher named C.R. Alder Wright created said replacement by chemically altering morphine And although it didn't make it to the medical market until 1895, it certainly made a splash when it did. What was this new synthesized substance, you ask? Heroin. This is truly shocking to even imagine, but by 1898, the pharmaceutical company Bayer was selling heroin-laced aspirin, which they openly marketed towards children, or at least to the parents of children. They said it would be useful to help relieve symptoms of coughs, colds, and headaches. But in the least surprising turn of events of all time, those who took it quickly became addicted to the substance. It wasn't until 1913 that the company thankfully ceased production of the medicine. And by the 1920s, heroin was made illegal in both the UK and the US. Honestly, when you look back, the truth really is stranger than fiction, isn't it? What on earth was going on? And here we arrive at our final section, but the one that has been a constant source of intense interest to myself since I was a teenager. And that is the Victorian approaches to mental health. As I said at the beginning, this topic is rough, so please take care. And feel free to skip this part if you are sensitive to discussions of mental health conditions and treatments. Back in episode 16 of the podcast, I covered this subject in relation to the story of my personal hero, Nellie Bly, who went undercover to expose the dire conditions of the late 1800s New York, quote, women's lunatic asylum. So if you haven't listened to that episode yet and are also fascinated by this topic, I definitely recommend checking that one out next. I focused heavily on the issues surrounding the treatment of women during the Victorian period and the control and abuse that was often exerted over them when it came to mental health conditions, or at least perceived mental health conditions. As I noted, the list of reasons a woman could be forcibly committed to an asylum, usually by her husband or a male relative, included but weren't limited to epilepsy, religious excitement, suppressed menstruation, depression after the death of a loved one, use of abusive language, overexertion, and nymphomania. Whereas I talked a lot about the social and political issues around Victorian attitudes to mental health in that installment of the podcast, I'm going to focus more on the quote-unquote treatments this time. Really, the first thing to note here is that treatment wasn't always at the forefront of the minds of those running the mental health facilities. Despite the 1853 Lunatic Asylum Act being introduced in England, which was meant to make things better for those committed to these institutions, asylums were very much considered to be more like prisons than hospitals. The emphasis was generally far more on keeping those inside away from wider society, rather than helping them to get well enough to re-enter society, regardless of sex. Although it's undeniable that admission rates were far higher for women. But here we loop back to the physical treatments I referred to earlier. In reality, there weren't many, but one of the most common yet troubling treatments was known as water therapy. If a patient was considered to be too up, for example, if they were hysterical or aggressive, this would usually involve very cold water. And if they were too down, suffering from what was described as melancholy, the water was often warm. This warm water therapy would frequently consist of a bath. But don't be tricked into thinking that that sounds quite pleasant. Patients could be left in the bath for many hours or even days at a time, with a canvas sheet being placed over the bathtub with only room for their head to stick out. But even this sounds preferable to the cold water treatment. Often, patients would be restrained, and ice-cold water either poured over their heads repeatedly or sprayed at their faces and bodies for extended periods. There's even evidence of people being submerged in water until unconscious, only for them to be brought back round and the torture repeated until they were considered, quote, better. Along with water therapy and all different kinds of restraints, our old friends, the leeches, were a common sight in asylums too, as bloodletting was considered to be another of the limited physical treatments that could potentially improve a patient's mental stability. It was also not unheard of for those in asylums to be starved. Personally, it wouldn't surprise me at all if this was simply another method of making patients so weak that they couldn't fight back and gave the staff less trouble, as truly horrible as that sounds. And if you're wondering why I haven't mentioned one of the most notorious and controversial procedures of all time, the lobotomy, that's because it's a common misconception that this was a truly Victorian treatment. It actually wasn't until the early 20th century that this became popular. I think I could probably do an entire episode about lobotomies. There is so much to cover. So do let me know if that's something you'd be interested in hearing more about. In terms of medicine, when it came to treating mental health conditions, if you're envisioning that perhaps there was a little glimmer of hope for patients on this front, I wish I could say there was, but this aspect left a lot to be desired too. Pyraldehyde was one of the main drugs administered to patients, but once more, I have a suspicion that in many cases, this was far more for the benefit of staff than those in need of care. It's essentially a sedative that suppressed the nervous system, and what would frequently happen is that it would be served to patients after their tea in the evening to make them sleepy and more compliant, regardless of their underlying issues. I suppose that unlike the excessive restraining techniques and barbaric water therapies, this was probably more to do with a lack of medical advancements, but still not ideal in my view. I will say that whilst in general, conditions at asylums could be horrifying, from a medical standpoint, there was such a lack of understanding of mental health conditions that most treatments didn't yet exist during the Victorian era. So if you can put aside the fact that a huge number of the patients shouldn't have been locked up in asylums in the first place, you can't totally blame those in charge for the lack of available treatments. To finish up today, I thought I'd leave you with a few of the most bizarre so-called Victorian cures that were published in the very first edition of the Merck Manual of Diagnosis and Therapy, which is a very famous series of medical textbooks all the way back in 1899. I'm sure I don't have to say this, but just in case, please do not try any of these at home. I only cite these to prove the point that much of the Victorian medical advice given back in the 19th century was pretty terrible. First up, whilst today we might be advised to hold our breath for a few seconds to try and get rid of hiccups, the Merck Manual advised its Victorian readers to try chloroform, specifically inhaling it, which seems like a very bad idea indeed. This one is unbelievable. The textbook recommended that those who suffered with asthma should start smoking. You truly could not make it up, but that just sounds so ridiculous to our modern ears. If you suffered from anemia, the writers of the manual advised a dose of arsenic. I don't even think I need to add commentary to that one, it's just unreal. Finally, if a patient was dealing with a bout of chickenpox, they were told to try a laxative to attempt to purge the disease from their body. This theme of purging is something that crops up often when we talk about Victorian medicine, but for chickenpox, really? Very, very strange. Now, on a serious note to end, although there are many issues with our healthcare systems today all across the world, most of which stem from chronic underfunding, looking back to a time that was not all that long ago, relatively speaking, really makes me feel grateful for the advancements that have been made. I've always been a huge supporter of the NHS here in the UK. I think the overwhelming majority of those who work in the service are incredible human beings, and we're very lucky to have them taking care of us. Looking to the past serves as a great reminder of why we have to protect what we have and recognise the good whilst always championing improvements that come in along the way. I think Florence Nightingale also predicted the way that healthcare might be viewed in the future, again inadvertently but no less accurately. In her words, "The very first requirement in a hospital is that it should do the sick no harm." I very much hope that you enjoyed that little dive into the vast, complicated, and incredibly intriguing history of Victorian medical practices. As I say, I could go on about each subtopic forever and ever, and if there's anything else you would like me to look into on this subject, please do feel free to let me know. A part 2 could definitely happen in the future. What did you make of this episode? Did you learn anything new? Did I give you flashbacks to your high school history classes? I would love to know. I'm going to be getting to all of our usual outro stuff right after a trip to the good old land of weird media. I feel like it's been absolutely ages since I recommended anything in weird media that wasn't a film, TV show, podcast, etc. And although it's pushing the boundaries of media in a way, I wanted to chat about an online shop I'm currently obsessed with. I think I've only done this once before with the Wicked Vintage online store, but this one is for lovers of alternative clothing and accessories. If you follow me over on my personal Instagram page, which is at Chiaz Samuel, you'll have seen that I mostly post about the outfits I'm wearing over there. I used to be a style blogger back in the day, and I feel like it's a passion of mine that had waned a bit over the past couple of years, but has now come back to me in full force, and I'm really having a lot of fun with fashion again. And my current favourite online shop is Disturbia. I recently bought a harness belt from there, and I keep wearing it with everything. The quality is so lovely, and I'm really impressed. And then the other day, I ordered a few items of clothing, treated myself a bit, and I loved every single thing so much that I'm keeping the lot. And that never happens to me with online shopping. The clothing is very much along the goth, grunge, alternative lines, but there are some really stunning pieces that I think could appeal to lots of people. Gorgeous tailored blazers and beautiful dresses and even super casual bits too. And just this morning, I had a look at the homeware and oh my goodness, I cannot cope with how cute it is. They have lots of botanical and celestial and nature themed items at the moment. Loads of mushroom prints, which I just adore, and I can see myself making a little order of ceramics very soon. Just to make it clear, by the way, this is not an ad. I just genuinely can't get enough of Disturbia, and I thought that anyone with a similar style to me might also love it. Do feel free to follow my personal Instagram if you'd like to see how I put my outfits together, and I'm sure you'll spot some Disturbia items in there along the way. Right, we have quite a few sore shoutouts to do, I can't lie, so I'm just going to get started. First up was a brilliant article from the Association of American Medical Colleges by Lindsay Coulter from October 2018, a History.com article from March 2023 by Bryn Holland, a piece from All That's Interesting about Robert Liston by Katie Serena from October 2017, a ScienceMuseum.org article about Joseph Lister from October 2018, and a BBC Science Focus piece about him by Alexander McNamara from April 2018. There was a great Washington Post piece by William Wan from October 2017 about 19th century surgery. Lots of great information on the old Operating Theatre Museum website. A piece about snake oil in the Pharmaceutical Journal by Andrew Haynes from January 2015. The Douglas Small Journal article, Masters of Healing, Cocaine and the Ideal of the Victorian Medical Man from January 2016. A mental floss article by Joan Voss MacDonald from July 2018. The website of the author V.L. McBeath was incredibly helpful. And finally, a paper from the University of Alabama by Samuel Yana Davies from 2011. Social media wise, you can find us on Instagram and Threads at Things Get Weird Podcast, and on Facebook by searching for Things Are About to Get Weird. If you're listening on Spotify, you can also leave your thoughts about this episode via the Q&A function. Any responses that are left there actually really help to push the podcast on the platform too. Ratings and reviews are also incredibly helpful as well. Last but not least, our email address is thingsgetweirdpodcast@gmail.com. Thank you so, so much for joining me today, and I'll chat to you again very soon in our next Weird Fix episode. So, until next time, take care of yourself and others, and keep it weird, for the good kind of weird.